Okay, so let's get started with the lecture itself. This is basically going to be a continuation of last time, and then I'll start the final topic, which is going to be on protection. Okay, so just to recap what we did last time, we were talking about distributed file systems. Okay, so these are file systems where the files that you access don't necessarily reside on the machine you are accessing them from. Okay, so what we did earlier in the class were local file systems where the disk was local, the files were local, the processes that were accessing these files were running on the same machines where the files were stored. Okay, in a distributed file system, the process or the application that's accessing the file is on some other machine, machine that's different from the machine where the files are stored. And distributed file systems allow you to access these files over a network. Okay, we looked at several issues. Okay, so let me actually go back a few slides to recap. So we looked at naming and transparency. Okay, important issue in a file system. It says, how are you going to specify the name of the file that you want to access, given that this file is stored on a different machine? Okay, we looked at absolute pathname, where you have to specify the machine name and the full name, path name on that host. Okay, very similar to URLs, those are absolute names. And we looked at mount points, where the OS sets up a mapping between the server and a subtree within that server, and gives it a local name. Okay, and then you just access it using that local name without any knowledge of where, what server you are accessing these files from. Okay, so NFS was an example of a system that uses mount points. Okay, and then going back to the list of issues, so then we looked at several other issues. Remote file accesses, what technique does the file system use to access different files? We said either you can send the read and write requests over to the server and the server processes them, or you bring the file over locally, you cache it, and all operations are local. And if you then modify the file, then at some later point you have to send the updated file back to the server. Okay, two methods: do the reads and writes remotely or do the reads and writes locally. Okay, so these are two techniques that are available to distributed file systems. We looked at the problem of caching. Okay, whenever you cache any file and you modify it, you have the problem of cache consistency. Okay, so you have a more up-to-date version of the data in your cache and a less an older version of the file on the server. So if some other client accesses that file, okay, it will get an old version of the file. So you have to ensure that whatever is stored on the server is reasonably up to date. It doesn't have to be always completely up to date, but it has to be very out of date. Okay, that's the problem of cache consistency. The variety of techniques that are used to ensure cache consistency, they could be either server based, which is the server's responsibility to ensure that data is consistent, or it could be client based, where the client's responsibility to ensure that updates are sent to the server in a timely fashion. Okay, so that's caching. And the last two things we looked at very quickly, which was, should the server be stateful or stateless? Okay, this is relevant from a cache consistency standpoint. The server is responsible for ensuring consistency. It has to track who are all the clients that have a copy of any file that have been accessed. Okay, that is state that's maintained on the server. Okay, so now if the data changes, you send notifications to those clients. Okay, so those are stateful file systems. They have some advantages in terms of performance, not performance, but consistency. But the disadvantage is if the server crashes, all of the state, which is typically maintained in memory, goes away. Okay, so any stateful system has this problem. If the state is stored in non-volatile memory, in RAM, and if there is a server crash or a reboot for any reason, state goes away. Okay, and then you have to deal with all the problems that are caused as a result of that. Okay, and the last thing I mentioned is replication. I said that thus far all of the file systems you have encountered, local file systems, distributed file system, have assumed implicitly that there is only one copy of a file in the file system. Okay, you can have replicated file system where entire volumes are replicated on multiple machines. Okay, and a client can then, if it wants to access file 2, it can go to any of the replicas to access this. Okay, this is done for performance reasons. If you have a file system that is very heavily accessed, a single server may not be able to service all of the requests. Okay, it may get overloaded and may not be able to service or scale to very large number of users. Okay, So you typically, in this case, you replicate the entire file system on multiple machines and the load is distributed across those machines. The same technique is used in web servers as well. If you have a small web server, your personal website, typically it runs on one machine somewhere. But if the popularity of your site grows, or if you take any popular website, typically the number of requests that are coming into that website exceeds the capacity of a single machine. A single machine cannot service that volume of requests. To address this, the only way to do this is to replicate. You can keep buying bigger and bigger machines, but at some point, even if you have the biggest machine, you may not be able to service the volume if your site is really popular. In this case, the only thing you can do is replicate. Okay, same is true in file servers. You can replicate your content, but then whenever you replicate, you are back to this consistency problem. There are multiple copies of the same file in your system. If one copy changes, if one file is returned to, then you have to ensure that other copies are brought up to date. Yeah, so you have to deal with all of these issues. Any questions on this? I'm going to now do a quick case study of NFS. That's the material we left out last time. Any issues with distributed file system that needs clarification? Okay. So NFS is the one that we look at maybe in a little more detail. It was one of the early file systems. It's a de facto standard on Unix file system, or rather Unix operating system. Okay, if you get any flavor of Unix, could be OS X, it could be Linux, it could be Solaris, all of them ship with NFS built in, NFS support built in. Okay, and the standard way to share files on your Unix world is to use NFS. Okay, it was originally designed by, originally designed by Sun, which is now Oracle. So Sun is basically gone. So yes, the predecessor of Oracle, which was Sun, designed back in the 80s. Okay, several versions of the NFS protocol have come out since it was originally designed. By default, what you get in most Linux or OS X or Solaris distributions are what is called version 3. Okay, it's a version 4 that was standardized a few years back. So, but it's still not widely implemented. It has some additional features. I'll say a few words about what those features are. Okay? And the interesting thing in NFS is any node, any machine on your system can be either a client or a server. Okay? It can take its files and share it with other machines, in which case it becomes a server for these files. And at the same time, it can access files that are stored on other machines. Okay? In, for those files, it is the client. Okay? So a machine can be a client or a server, or at any given time, or both. Okay, some machines could only be servers, some machines could only be clients, but in general a machine could be serving some files to other machines and accessing files from some other machine. Okay, so it could play the role of both the client or a server. That's something to keep in mind. Okay, but typically NFS was designed as a stateless system. The server did not keep any state of what clients are accessing the data and so on. Okay. So what this means is every request that goes to the server, okay, has to have complete information saying I am such and such user, this is the file I am trying to access, this is the location from which I want to access it, so you can specify the offset, say I want to read or write this much data. Okay. Because there is no state kept at the server, every request has to be fully descriptive. Okay. There are advantages and disadvantages to this. The advantage is that the stateless servers are very simple to implement. They are robust to crashes and whatnot. The disadvantage is every request has to have all of this information embedded in there effectively. Okay. In a typical file system, you just open the file, okay, and then the operating system knows that you opened the file, you just continue to read it. Every request, you don't go and say, I am this user and I want to access this file and I want to access it at this offset. Once you open the file, you get a file pointer, okay, or a file handle. You just use that handle to access the file. The concept of opening a file does not even exist in NFS because there is no state. You just send off a read request and every request has to be checked, saying, does this user have the right privileges, can they access files and so on. Okay. So that's something to keep in mind. So until version 3, okay, NFS was stateless. Okay. Version 4 introduced some state at the server, okay, because you can only take this so far. Okay. So version 4 is stateful. It can keep track of which clients are accessing what files because it supports both the caching model as well as the remote access model. Okay, to do this, you have to keep some state. Okay, so that's version 4. Okay, the equivalent analogy to stateful, statelesser, or all of these, you can find analogies in the web. Okay, so suppose you are going, let's take the web case. Suppose you go, you open a browser, you go to some website. Okay, let's say you go to Amazon, okay, and you basically then take some item and you put it in your cart, in your shopping cart. Okay, now if you can design your system in many ways. Okay, you could make the server stateful, in which case there is the state of your shopping cart is actually stored at the server. Okay, so if at some later time you go and say, I want to now buy what's in my shopping cart, that state, what you had put in the shopping cart, that's actually kept in the server. Okay, those are stateful servers. If that server crashes, okay, and the state was in memory, then that state is gone. And if the server reboots, your shopping cart will be empty. Okay, another way to design the exact same application, okay, like the Amazon or any e-commerce application, is to store the state in the client and in the browser. So if you put something into the shopping cart, if you have a stateless server, what that server would do is it would encode the contents of your shopping cart as a cookie. Okay? It would send that cookie to the browser. So now the browser keeps the state of what's in the shopping cart. So the next time you send a request, you have to send this cookie with the request so the server can reconstruct the state of what you had done, what was in your shopping cart. Every request, you have to actually send the cookie back. Okay, so that's extra information you have to keep, because the server is not tracking what users are doing. Every time you take an action, you encode whatever the end result is in the cookie and you send it back. All of your shopping state is actually stored in this cookie. It's on the browser end. Okay? So you can see that now requests become larger in size, because every time you send this request, any request to the server, you have to include the cookie with it, so the server knows who you are, what have you done thus far in this session and whatnot. Okay? The exact same principle applies in the file distributed file system case. If you have stateful systems, once you open the file, the state of what you have done, your session, file session, is stored at the server. So it's much easier for the server to then interpret requests. If not, then you get the equivalent of a cookie. It's called a magic cookie, actually. In NFS, it's sent back to the client. Every time the client sends a request, it has to include this magic cookie and send that to the server, so the server knows what you have done. Okay, that's something to keep in mind. I already mentioned this mount protocol that's used in NFS. It was mount protocol was originally designed in NFS. The way it's done is there are configuration files that are specified. The servers have to basically use this file called exports to tell the operating system what files can be remote accessed by remote client. Okay, you are exporting your file system. It says you can, this files can be accessed by these sets of machines. Okay? So that's specified by the server. So the server says, I am willing to share this file. Okay? What clients have to do is at boot time, they have to say, I want to take these files stored on these servers and I want to construct a local mapping. Okay? And so that's what is called mounting. You take that volume and you mount it locally in some part of your subtree. At that point, it becomes accessible to the users on this machine, can now get access to files that are stored on this other machine. Okay? This is referred to as mounting. Now, modern versions of NFS support something called auto-mounting. They don't set up this mapping when the system boots up. They just read this mapping and keep it in memory and construct the mapping on demand, on the fly. Okay? The moment you actually touch something that was a mount point, you then go and access that system. Okay, that's typically how things work. Okay, so I can show you an example. Let's see. Oh, interesting. Okay, so let's see what we can mount here. So you can just see that I just CD'd into this and I mounted all the volumes that were exported from that server. If you do df, you will see now these two things have appeared. Okay, so this is what is exported on that system. So you could now go in and mount additional things on demand. Okay, so let's go into NFS directory. Something called new world. Okay, so now if you see, you will see that all of these things got mounted on demand just because I accessed them. Okay, so there are 30 directories that I've gotten. So this is called auto mounting. Okay, the system doesn't mount all of these 100 directories as when this the OS boots up. It just waits. If you actually try to access any path that is on a mount point, it will go and dynamically or on the fly mount those directories. Okay, this prevents you from wasting resources and mounting things that you'd never access. Okay, you just mount on demand. And if you stop accessing these directories after a timeout value, it will unmount it automatically. That clear? So this is called auto mounting. Okay, it's a feature that NFS supports. As the mapping is read, but it is not instantiated. Okay, you instantiate the mapping on demand, and you access as and when you access remote files. Okay, so that's NFS. Now let's look at some internals of NFS. There are two slides here. Okay, the important thing to keep in mind is NFS is built on top of RPC. Okay, so it uses remote procedure calls that we studied two classes back to implement all of its operation. So essentially what happens is, let's say this is your client, that's your server. Okay. As the client issues read, write to files, okay, these essentially at the OS level become a read RPC that's sent to the server or a write RPC that's sent to the server. Okay. The NFS server code here processes these read-write calls. Okay, it actually accesses the files from disk using read-write, sends back the response. Okay, and then the response is handed back to the client. Okay, so this is essentially how all file operations, all local file operations that you see, essentially become RPC operations in NFS. Okay, you make that local file call, it translates internally at the OS level into an RPC call that is sent by the NFS client code in the kernel to the NFS server code. NFS server code then processes it, actually accesses the file, sends back the result. Okay? That's the thing to keep in mind, that NFS is implemented on top of RPCs. In fact, this was the first widely used applications of RPCs. The first real application. RPCs were designed by Sun mainly to implement NFS. Okay? Then they realized that this remote procedure call mechanism can be used for writing other distributed applications. So then they made their RPC compiler and whatnot, and this published the RPC spec, so you could use it to write other apps. Yeah, but this was first, RPCs were first designed by Sun to implement NFS. Okay, so that's sort of a historical thing to keep in mind. Okay, the other interesting thing about RPC is that it doesn't, not RPC, rather NFS, is that it does not depend on the platform. Okay. You can have a Windows machine that implements an RPC NFS client, rather access files that are stored on a Linux box. Okay. You can have a Solaris machine export files that are accessed by an OS X machine. Okay. All this just works. Okay. NFS protocol is designed to be multi-platform, cross-platform. Okay. The reason it is that's the case is because the underlying RPC layer does all of the cross-platform magic for you. Okay. It deals with whether this architecture on the server is big Indian and the clients are little Indian architecture or vice versa. All of that translation is done by the RPC layer. In fact, RPC itself is a cross-platform system. Okay. You can write your RPC application. Okay. You can have part of the application run on OS X, make an RPC call to a Linux box or a Solaris box, and things just work. Okay, because the system is designed that way. Same is true, incidentally, of Java. Because Java, once you have a JVM, you don't care what the platform is. So you can use Java RMI, and your one part of the application may be running Java on Solaris, and the other one may be running Java on Windows. You can have that application talk to one another. Okay, because all of these remote methods systems, RPC systems, are designed to be cross-platform. Okay. So this is a picture to keep in mind, which shows you a blown-up version of that. So this is the client. Okay. So you have the system call interface, and then there's something called the VFS layer, okay, or a virtual file system layer. And then below this layer, you actually have file systems. There may be a variety of them, Okay, so here you have something called UFS. This is a local file system in Solaris. This could be ext3, ext4, ext2, whatever else you want. Okay, in Linux. Okay, and then there is NFS, which is another file system that is supported in Linux and other Unix like. So if you make a call to a remote, or you make a file IO to a remote file, what happens is it comes through the file system interface. The read and write call comes to the virtual file system layer, and then the virtual file system layer will then forward that remote file accesses to the NFS client code. That will send RPC request to the server, response comes back, and then it goes back up. Okay. If you access local file, the path you follow is it comes to the system call layer, to the virtual file system layer, to the local file system. So you actually take this path through the kernel, okay, as opposed to that path. Okay. Now, as far as users are concerned, they don't need to know all this, right? So you just access files as if they are local. Okay. So remote files appear as if they are local files. All of this is done in the operating system. It decides whether the file is remote, local. It figures out what code to invoke within the kernel depending on whether it's remote or local. Okay. So this is the abstraction that is provided, called the virtual file system or the VFS layer, that supports a variety of these file systems, okay, inside the kernel. So this is basically a large case statement, or a if then statement. If the file system type is UFS, call this code. If the file system is FAT32, call some other code. If it's NTFS, call. So all of these are file systems that you plug into the kernel. Okay? And this is where the OS decides which code to invoke to service this read, write, open, whatever the file request is. Okay? So if you write a new file system of your own, which you are doing in this last lab, but you are not writing a real file system, that's a dummy file system. But if you were to write a real kernel module that implements a file system, you would actually plug it in here, yeah, as one more file system in your operating system. Essentially, the code that you will write as a kernel module, not as a Java program. And then you would plug that here, and then you would make that file system become available to the VFS layer. And then the VFS layer then can start forwarding requests of your file system type to your code. Okay, this is how it would actually work within the kernel. Any questions here? Okay. So that's basically it for NFS. What I will do now is, so I have a few slides on protection. Okay, this is one of the chapters that I had skipped when we were going through the material in the book. This is actually chapter 14. We have gone back from 18 back to 14. So I will say a few words about protection, maybe in half an hour, and then we'll do some other things. Okay, so what is protection? So I'll talk about what does protection mean. Okay, how is protection typically provided? We'll talk about the notion of a domain. We'll talk about what an access matrix is. We'll see how to implement protection within operating systems. We'll look at access control lists and capabilities. These are two different ways. And then I'll say something about capability-based system, and then how language-based protection can be achieved. Okay, so let's start with protection. Okay. So essentially here what we are trying to do is, you have within an operating system many resources. This could be files, this could be printers, variety of these other resources. And if users or administrators want to implement some policies which say these resources can be accessed by these processes and these users, okay, what is the feature within the operating system that allows you to specify flexible policies that so that users or processes can access the resources to which they have rights to? Okay. This is achieved by the protection subsystem within the OS kernel. Okay. So typically, as I said here, OS consists of a collection of objects. Objects would be hardware objects or software objects. Each object has a unique name. Okay. The easiest way to understand this is, think of, whenever I say object, think file. Okay. Because the same applies for any other object. So each object has a unique name and can be accessed through a well-defined set of operations. If this was a file, each file has a name. It is accessed through a well-defined interface, which is your file I/O interface. Okay? So the protection problem is to ensure that each object is accessed correctly and only by those processes that are allowed to do so. So if you have a file that's being accessed by a process, you only want processes that have the right access privileges to access that file. If it's your file, you don't want to share this file with anyone, you don't want somebody else to get access to it. How does the operating system ensure this? Yeah, that's basically the problem of protection. Okay. So to understand that, there is this abstraction called a domain. Okay, that is used in operating systems. Okay, so we'll first start with this term called access right. Okay, an access right is essentially the subset of all operations that are allowed on that object. Okay, so you have the name of the object and the set of rights that you have basically given to anyone. Okay, so here is basically an access right saying object O3. This would be file foo. Somebody has a read permission and somebody has a write permission. Okay. That's what is referred to as an access right. And a domain is essentially a set of access rights. Okay, so this is a domain which says that here are the set of accesses that are allowed by the on these objects. In this variety of objects. Okay. Thus far this is abstract. I'll make this concrete in just 1 second. Okay. So is the concept of an access right and domain clear? Okay. So let's take Unix and try to understand what domains are supported and what are. So you, in Unix there are two domains. Okay, you are either a user or you are a super user. Okay. Or root. So these are the two domains. So everything basically is partitioned into these two categories. Okay, users always have less privileges than super users. Okay. So domain is same as a user. Okay, so what I am said domain on the previous slide is same as a user. Okay, so then you say this user has these rights, this other user has this other rights and so on and so forth. And then we'll talk about the domain switch, saying you essentially use the file system mechanism to switch from one user to another. Okay. Typically, if you actually carefully look at the file privileges, you will see that certain files have privileges which are called set UID. Okay. So that means that file actually belongs to another user, but if you try to access the file, you do so as if you are that other user. Okay. This is referred to as changing the UID on the process. Okay, the process actually acquires the rights that belongs to some other user. Typically, this is done for files that require root privileges. Okay, so if the root sets the set UID bit on for a file and you try to execute that file, you automatically get the privileges of the super user. Okay, this is what you tell the file system. If user foo accesses this file, assume that user foo becomes root just for accessing these files. Okay, so you basically get different privileges, okay, using this notion of a set UID. Okay, but we can ignore that just for the moment. Let's look at some other, so we talked about Unix. Multics has this other hierarchical domain implementation as is shown here. So each domain could be a user. So you have this notion of a ring. So you specify what privileges ring zero has. Okay, those are if you are a user that belongs to ring 0, you get those privileges. Okay, and then you keep expanding these privileges. So, and if you are ring 1, then you get all the privileges of ring 0 plus some other privileges and so on. Okay, so a super user, you can think of them as the outermost ring. You have all the privileges that you have in any system. Okay, the most restricted user in the system is ring 0. Okay. And any other user falls anywhere between ring 0 and ring N. Okay. So access privileges are strictly hierarchical. Okay. Contrast that with this picture I showed you where you can have arbitrary subset. This is not a hierarchical system. This says this user can do write on O2, can do print on O4, has no privileges on O1 and O3. And then this other user has some privileges for accessing, let's say, file O1 and O3. Can print O4, has no privileges on O2. So this is basically not a hierarchical model. Okay, different users have different subsets of privileges and that they intersect differently. Okay. In the multics world, D3 would actually, if that's an outer ring, would have all the privileges of D2 and some more. Okay, so you can only expand outwards. You cannot deny whatever an inner ring has to some outer ring. Okay. So that's basically the protection mechanism that was implemented in multics. Okay. For those of you who haven't heard of what multics is, so as a predecessor of Unix, okay, designed back in the 70s, it was a large project, turned out to be a complete failure, okay, because it was very complicated, could never get the code to work. Okay, so in the end, after several years of effort, they threw the whole thing out. and some of the Multics designer then went back and said, what did we learn from this failure? And then they built Unix. So I think of Unix as the most successful descendant of what Multics should have been. Okay, so they essentially threw out all the complexity, designed this very simple model. So you can see that Unix essentially does implement the Multics privilege ring. Okay, if you assume that all users have certain privileges, super users have everything that users can do and some more. Okay, so that's basically a simplification of this very complicated model, because I think it's very hard to implement this in any practical system, but that's what they try to do. Any questions on this? Okay, so now I'll talk about something a little more concrete, which is the notion of an access matrix. Okay, now, having defined what an object is and what a domain is, let's look at how you can specify some policies within any operating system that dictate which users get access to which objects. Okay, this is done using a simple matrix, okay, called an access matrix, where the rows are domains and columns are objects, and it's easiest seen with the picture. Okay, so think of these are domains are users, okay, in our world. Okay, objects are files. Okay, this is a list of all the files in your system. This is a list of all the users in your system. Each entry says, for what can this user do to that file? Okay, and you specify whatever you want that user to do, read, write, execute. So you will see that there are different entries here. Okay, so by specifying the right entry, you can grant this user appropriate privileges to a certain file. Okay, so the operating system views whatever has been specified for the all users and all files as essentially a large access matrix, okay, where you have users as rows, the columns as files or other objects, and each entry tells the operating system what can that user do. Okay, so now if user D3 opens file F2 in write mode, all that the operating system has to do is look up this entry and say, does this user have write privileges on this file? In this case, the answer is no. Okay, so if you try to open the file in this file in write mode, you will get an error saying you don't have the access rights to open the file in write mode. But you can open the file in read mode, okay, because you have that privilege. Okay, so anytime you actually open any file, essentially what the OS is doing is checking the right entry in your access matrix, saying do you have those privileges. If the answer is yes, then you get the your operation succeeds. If it's no, then it doesn't. Okay, is the notion of an access matrix clear?
What is the domain exactly?
Think of domain as users. This is user 1, user 2, user 3, user 4. Objects are files. So user, so by user we also mean a process. So your process has your user ID. So this is, when a process tries to open a file, the process is owned by a user. That's the user that started that process. So the process inherits all the rights of the user. Okay, so then the OS will then check the who is the owner of that process. Does that owner actually have those privileges? Yes, question.
Domains would also include groups.
Domains would also include groups, which is why you have this more abstract concept. You can have groupings of users, not just individual users. And this, as I said, objects can be more than just files. They could be any arbitrary thing like printers and other abstract objects. Okay, is that clear? Any other question on this? Okay. So I already said this. So if process in domain D, a process that belongs to a certain user, tries to do a certain operation on that object, you basically have to look in the access matrix and see, is that operation present here? If read is present, then you are allowed to do read it. If not present, you cannot access it. Okay, so that's how you can do this. And then the interesting thing is this access matrix is not static. Okay, it can keep changing. Administrators can add privileges, they can remove privileges, they can remove entire users. Okay, as clearly the files keep changing. The files can, new files can get created, files can get deleted. So this is a dynamic data structure. Okay, where users can change, the rights of a user can change, the columns can also change, okay, depending on what files are present or not. So think of this as a structure that keeps changing all the time. So for every operation, you have to go and check the structure. So you can't just check it once because it can keep changing.
So
on the fly.
So where do you grant the rights for the domain?
Where do you grant the rights for the domain?
Yeah, so
yeah, so think or look at this user. This user can read that file, it can write that file. Okay? The same user can read and write that file. The user cannot access this file at all because this entry is blank. So you're asking how do you create this entry? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, so when you want to grant.
Yes, so I will talk about how to implement an access matrix in just 1 second. So that's coming. Okay, so this is just how, once you have an access matrix, how do you check whether you have the right privileges? Okay, now you are asking a good question, then how do these entries get created? We will see that in just a second. Okay, so the interesting thing to keep in mind is all that the OS is doing is giving you a mechanism that is very flexible, that allows the user or the administrator to specify a policy. Okay, the OS does not implement policy. The OS does not dictate that this user can only read or write certain files. That is left to the administrator or the other users that are creating these files to say who can access the files that they are creating. Right? So it's just a mechanism. These entries are actually policies that you have implemented in a certain system. This user has had these rights because that's the policy. Either the user owns that file or some other user that owns that file has given this user these privileges. Right? So there is this separation of mechanism from policy. Okay. The access matrix is merely a mechanism, and how users use that system is basically what policies get implemented using the access matrix. Okay, so now let's come to this question of how do these entries get created. Okay. To understand this, we have to look at actual implementation of this access matrix. Okay, this access matrix is an abstract concept. This is not really a matrix that is stored in the kernel. Okay. The way you actually implement this is two different ways. You can implement your access matrix as what's called an access control list, or you can implement the same access matrix using what's called a capability list. Okay? The difference between the two is whether the access matrix is stored in a column fashion inside the OS or is it stored in a row fashion. Okay? Most operating systems that you encounter in practice actually store this access matrix in a column fashion, which means with each file, okay, they will store the privileges that have been granted on this file. Okay, that's called an access control list for that file. Okay, so for file F1 in the inode for that file, you will actually store all of this information, saying who can access this file, how can they access it and whatnot. Okay, that's how this access matrix is actually implemented. Okay, so this is a column implementation of the access matrix. It's called an access control list. Okay, I'll show that in just one moment. You can also have row-based implementation. Yeah, you typically don't see the system, but they exist. In row-based implementation, essentially with each user, okay, with each user ID, you store a list of all these privileges. You can say, you have a list saying, this user can do reads and writes on file F1, and you can do read and write on file F3, and so on. So you store a list with the user. So when the user logs in, you basically go access this list. That's everything that the user can do in the system. Okay? That's a row-based implementation. A row-based implementation is referred to as a capability list. Okay? So depending on whether you store the access matrix in a row-wise or column-wise fashion, you get two different implementations that have two different ways of storing this. Okay? One is you basically store per user. The other one is you store per object. Okay, if you store per object, then you basically for each object you have, say, user 1 can do that, or domain 1 can do that, and domain 2 can do that, and domain 3 can do that, and so on. Okay, so let's look at Unix for just a second. I'm trying to understand. I think I mentioned this when we did file systems. Typically in the Unix world, there are three domains, okay, for every file. Okay, you have the user or the owner of the file. Okay, that's domain, one domain. There's a group, and there's something called world, who's everyone else. Okay, so you have basically three different domains. Okay, for each domain, you basically can specify for each file, read, write, and execute privileges. Okay, so user or the owner of the file will have certain privileges on the file, read, write, execute, the group that the file belongs to, or rather the group that the user belongs to, okay, is another domain. You can specify access control on the group, and you can specify access control on world, all the other remaining users in the system. Okay. This is the Unix world of compacting, and access control list is arbitrary because you can have arbitrary number of users with read, write, execute permission. Unix collapses this into three categories, three bins: the owner of the file, the group that the owner belongs to, and everyone else. Okay. This is a simplification of an access control list. Okay, this ensures that the access control list is essentially 9 bits. You have 1 bit for each of these. If the bit is on, that means you have that privilege. If the bit is off, that means there is no, that privileges is missing. So your inode needs to have only 9 bits to store the access control list, this type of access control list in Unix, okay, which is very compact, as opposed to an arbitrary set of users. So if there were 1,000 users, typically an access control list can have 1,000 entries. Okay, that means it can be of arbitrary size, and you have to store that arbitrary size ACL in the inode. Okay. So Unix philosophy is keep it simple. Okay, so you basically have this. Now modern file systems, even in the Unix world, can actually go beyond this. They support this, but they also support arbitrary access control lists. Okay, so I can show you an example. So this is basically, if you do ls minus l, you will see all these bits. So you say read, write, execute, read, write, execute, read, write, execute. That basically says this is the user privileges, group, and world. Okay. This is what is done by default. This is the Unix. So let's just create a file called foo. Okay, so now if you see this, you will see that by default, I have read and I am the owner. So I have read, write, but no execute, and no one, the group and the world don't have anything. So you can then go and do things like change the mode, and then you can say group plus read write foo. So now what has happened is I have essentially added some privileges. So the group didn't have any rights. Now I added read and write rights to my group, okay, which is that group, and so on. Okay. Now this is the standard old Unix way. Okay, now this is Linux, so it also supports more general access control list. Okay, the way you do that is you say get file access control list foo. Okay, so if you do get facl on foo, it will show you this. Okay, at this point there is no extra privilege. Okay, so it says that's the file, that's the owner, that's the group. User does read write, no execute, the same as that. Group does read write, and world does nothing. Okay, so right now there is no real access control list that's associated with it, okay, but you can add it. So the way you do this is you say what I'm trying to do now is I will add one more user to my access control list. Okay, that's that user. I'm going to grant that user read and write privileges. Okay, maybe we can give all privileges. Okay, so read, write, execute. Okay, so now if you go back and can look at the file access. So you will see. So this is the owner. The owner has read and write privileges, added a user. Okay, so this user can now access this file in read, write, and execute mode. This is in addition to these privilege bits. I added one more list here, one more thing here. Okay, so you can add this, make this arbitrary. So any user you can now, so you can add one more user. Let's say, so now your access control list is grown. Okay, see, there are now two users. So this can keep growing. You can grant arbitrary privileges to arbitrary users. Okay. So this is, as I was saying, the row-based or rather column-based implementation. For every file, this list is maintained. Okay. So that's basically your column. So you have this for each user. you can specify arbitrary privileges. Okay? Any questions? Okay, so we can remove that file. Yeah, so this is what you typically see. Okay, Windows uses ACLs, Linux uses ACL, Unix also uses ACLs. So this row-based implementation is called capabilities. These are used in only certain operating systems. They're mostly research prototypes, haven't actually made it out in the real world, but they do exist. Okay? And in this case, you basically, for each user, you will store a big long list saying, this user, here are all the objects in the system, what can that user do? Okay? You don't store anything with the object itself. Okay? You store with the user. So when the user tries to access something, you basically go and say whether you have in those privileges for that object. Okay? It gives you the exact same flexibility. Neither of these mechanisms is more powerful than the other. These are just two different implementations of the access control. It's a row-based or a column-based implementation. Is that clear? Okay. So the two systems just two examples. So there's a system called Hydra, which was an operating system built, I think, 15-20 years ago, which introduced this notion of a capability. Okay. So it introduced this notion of a row-based capability. See, then there was another system called the CAP system, okay, which also had similar ideas. Okay. It also used a capability-based system, but for whatever reason, this has never taken off. Okay, the Unix way of having this column-based implementation still remains the way to do access matrices in operating systems. Okay, so the last thing I'm going to say here is language-based protection. So thus far we have talked only about OS-based protection. The same has to be done at the language level. Okay, so it's best understood using how things are done in Java. In Java, protection is handled by the JVM, the Java Virtual Machine. So whenever you actually, this all happens in the background, so you don't see it. Whenever you load a class in your application, it is assigned a protection domain. Okay? That basically tells the JVM what can you do with the methods of this class. Okay? So the protection domain indicates what operations the class can and cannot perform. So if you invoke a library method that performs a privileged operation, you basically look at the stack of your process within the JVM to see if you can actually do, if you can invoke that protection, not that protection mechanism, but that privileged operation. Okay, so what you will do, I'll show you up in the picture. Okay, so let's say there are two classes. Foo.bar, well, let's call foo.method1, and within this you call method for another class, and then within bar your method 2 you do a privileged operation. Let's say you do a system call. Okay. What JVM will do is it will first check, okay, so you are in method 2 belonging to class bar. Does this class have enough privilege to do this privileged operation? If the answer is yes, you go ahead and do it. Okay. If the answer is no, then you say, who has called this method? Okay, then you basically say, okay, this method was called by method 1 of class foo. Okay. Then you say, does foo now have privilege to actually call that system call? If so, because this class called this method within this class called that method, you granted that privilege. If the answer is no, then you say, who called method 1? Okay. Then you go one level up in the stack and check, okay, does that class for that method have the right privileges and so on, until you go all the way to your main program. Okay. If no one has the privilege, no class has that privilege, you will deny that operation. If someone in your stack chain has the privilege, you will grant that operation. Yeah, that's essentially what this is saying. Okay, so you basically look at the stack to see if some class in your stack chain actually has the right privileges to do that operation. Okay, and only then do you allow it. So this is basically how you will do this. Now typically in your Java code you may not do any significant privilege operation, so you don't see any of this. But if you actually do something strange that requires you to do privileged operation, you might see an error saying you do not have the access privilege to do this. Okay, that's how it actually works. Okay, any questions on this? This is language based protection. Okay, it's the same principle applies in the JVM. Whatever we said for the OS world, the same abstract concepts will apply here. Okay, so except that here your objects are classes, not files. Okay? Okay, so that is actually it for protection. Okay, and that's really all I have to say as far as the material from the book is concerned. Okay, so what I will do now is to just do a wrap up. Okay, next, there is a class next week. Okay, this is not the end of the lecture, but that class is going to be a guest lecture. Okay, so this is the last regular lecture for the course. Okay, so if you made it this far, you have done a good job. So I think that I'll do a wrap up, but I just wanted to say a few words about the course. So I looked at the overall performance of the class and so on, and things look pretty good. Okay? Seems to be a big difference from this class last semester. Okay, I don't know if you know, but last semester nearly half the students had to actually fail the class. Okay, it was a big problem. So I wasn't sure coming in, I didn't teach that class, but I wasn't sure coming in what was going to happen this time. Okay, but it looks like things seem to have gone pretty smoothly. Okay, I had to make some changes. I switched the project from C++ to Java and whatnot because students had lots of problems with C++, autograder and whatnot. So those changes seem to have helped. And here we are at the end of the course. So we still have the last project due, but based on my review, things seem to be going generally well, okay, on target as it should. Okay, so with that, let me say something about the final exam. Okay, so it's going to be cumulative. Okay, I mean everything that we have done is on the test. Okay, but we will emphasize the latter part of the course. Okay, whatever we have done since midterm 2 will be at least half the exam. Okay, 50-60% of the course, and then there will be some emphasis on the previous concepts. So it's cumulative, but more of the emphasis on the latter part and less on the what was on exam 1 and 2. Okay, so IO systems and later is basically what will be bulk of the final. And I'm going to review that. But let me start with sort of where we were at the beginning. So we started with, so there were four components, if you remember. We did process management, memory management, we did IO subsystems, and then we did distributed system. So those are four components of the course. Okay. First exam was broadly on process management. Second exam was broadly on memory management, and the final will, as I was saying, will have the last two components with more of the emphasis. But let's start with process management. Okay, so this is not only a wrap-up, it's also an indication of things that you should know by now and might be questions on the test. Okay, so you need to know what's a context switch, what happens during the context switch, the fact that you switch from one process to another in the CPU scheduler, what you need to know what's a thread, how is that different from a process. Okay, process is essentially an address space with one thread of execution, and threads basically allow you to have multiple control flows within the same address space. Okay, so you need to know that. You need to go back and review all of the CPU scheduling algorithms. Okay, we started with first come first serve, we did round robin with the shortage of first and multi-level feedback queue. Okay, so if we have, I think we had a test, on the test we had a question on MLFQ. Okay, but there were all these other things that we also studied here. Okay, we looked at the notion of an IO bound process. This is a process that does mostly IO with short bursts of CPU, and the CPU bound process, which is the opposite. It does mostly computation with little IO. Okay, and we said how should the OS treat these two different types of processes? Okay, which one should be given priority, why is that the right thing to do, and so on. Okay, so that's process and thread management. Okay, and then we spent quite a bit of time on synchronization. Okay, we looked at three abstractions, semaphore, locks, and monitors. Okay, So you need to know what are semaphores, what can they be used for, what's a lock. I don't know why there is no lock here. So you should also know what's a lock. Then you should know what's a semaphore, what's a monitor. Within the notion of a monitor, what's a condition variable. Okay? It should be clear by now. There's a test question on that. Okay? So you should need to know that. It's a useful concept if you do any synchronization based programming. Okay? You need to know what's busy waiting, why that is typically bad in any system. This is where you spin in a loop doing nothing, waiting for something to occur. Okay? Four conditions on deadlock, you need to know, but there's not going to be a test question. You already had one this time. Okay, so you need, then what's the difference between deadlock detection and deadlock prevention? Okay, and then after detecting deadlocks, how do you recover from it? Okay, and you can terminate processes, you can take back resources and so on. Okay, this process management. Okay, next set was basically IO. Okay. Memory management and then also some IO stuff that's related to that. We looked at several schemes starting with contiguous allocation. Okay, then we looked at paging, looked at segmentation and segmented paging, and then we looked at demand paging, which is also virtual memory. Okay, so you need to know all of these concepts. What does each do? What are the advantages and disadvantages of each of them? Okay, so what is virtual memory? How do we use it? What's paging? Where does the OS store the page table? It's going to be either in memory or in TLB. Okay, you need to know what's a TLB, how it's a fast cache for storing segment table and page table entries. You need to know the concept of a page fault. Okay, this is where not the entire process is not in memory at the same time. Some parts of the process are in disk, some are in memory. Okay, if you try to access a part of the process that's on disk, you have a page fault and you bring that page in and then the process resumes execution. Okay, so that's what a page fault is. We looked at several page replacement algorithms. Okay, we looked at FIFO, we looked at opt or min. It's an optimal algorithm. Okay. Then we looked at LRU and then we spent an entire lecture looking at approximations of LRU. Okay. We looked at this thing called clock or second chance, and we looked at enhanced second chance. So go back, review all of that material. Okay, saying what is, why do we need an approximation at all should also be clear. I said LRU requires you to have one memory access to do bookkeeping for each memory reference. Okay, that's very expensive to do. So you need more efficient implementations of LRU. Okay, that you can save on this bookkeeping over it. Okay, so that's basically what second chance and other approximations do. Okay, and then we have looked at IO devices. Okay, I have another slide on this, so let me come back to that. Okay, so again, this scheduling you have done of several of these. Okay, FIFOs, shortest seek time first, scan, C-scan. We also looked at this one called LOOK, which is an optimization. So I'll say something about that in the next slide. Okay, so memory management, these are the schemes. Okay, there should be demand paging here, contiguous allocation, paging, segmentation, and page segmentation. Okay, and then finally demand paging. Okay, within memory management, address translation. Okay, how do virtual addresses get translated to physical addresses? What hardware do you need to do that translation? What parts of an address do what types of translation? There's a segment number, page number, offset. All of these are components of that address. Okay? You need to understand which of the schemes on the previous slide have the ability to grow shrink processes and which ones it's harder to do that. Which ones is it easy to share memory with other processes? So paging, segmentation makes sharing easy. Contiguous allocation, you can't share at all. Okay. Ability to move processes for compaction due to swapping and so on. Okay. Which ones is it easy, which ones is more difficult. And memory protection. Okay. We looked at where pages could be read-only. Okay. In the context of segmentation, if you remember, said there's a code segment, there's a data segment. Okay. Code segment is typically read-only. You only read instructions, you don't update those instructions. Data segments are read-write. You have local variables, you can read them or write them. Okay. What do you need to do to make that happen? Okay. Typically, you have read-write bits that are associated with segments or pages. Okay. That tells the OS what operations are allowed, what are not allowed. Okay. So you need to go review all of that and understand how that works. Okay. And then again, you do context switches, what memory management information needs to be saved and restored. Okay. Page table information, TLB entries, etc. Okay, so the So that was sort of pre-exam 2. Yeah, exam 2 and earlier. So this is now whatever has happened since then. Okay, so we studied file systems. Okay, so you need to know what's a file, what's the formal definition of a file, what are file types, how does the OS use them. Okay, file types are basically, if you know what are the contents of a file, then you have a typed file system. If you ignore the contents of a file like Unix does, then you have a typeless file system. Okay, your typed file system, you can do things like if you double click on a file, you can start an application that's associated with a file, things like that can be done. Okay, what types of accesses are typical for files? Sequential and random. Okay, there are two types of file accesses. Either most applications either do sequential access on the file or random access. Okay, you will learn enough about random access by the time you do, you're done with lab 4. Okay, so you will know everything you need to know about random access. Okay, what do we do on different file operations? Okay, what happens on an open? What happens on a read? We had pseudo code for all of this. Go and review that. Okay, so you understand how each of those operations are implemented by the file system. Okay, and then we looked at what's a directory. Okay, this is a folder, that's a collection of files. What's a link? This is like a shortcut in Windows. You have symbolic links and hard links. Okay, how do they work? What are the differences between them? Okay. So we looked at the directory structure. The hierarchy, he said, is not a tree, it's a graph. Okay. But it's an acyclic graph. He said you try to prevent cycles within the graph. Okay. You need to know why. Okay. We said if you have things like backup programs, if you have a cycle, then if you try to back up a directory, you will just keep looping forever. Okay. You have problems like that you must avoid. And for that very reason, you prevent any cycles in a directory structure. Okay, then you need to know how does an OS support multiple users. Okay, how do you do file sharing and so on. Okay, and then there were inode structures that we looked at within the file system, and the file allocation, just contiguous allocation, linked allocation and indexed allocation. Okay, contiguous allocation, the file is stored contiguously. In the linked, it's stored as a linked list. That's what early DOS-based file system do. Indexed allocation is what happens in Unix. Okay, in fact, you have multi-level index. That's what is in the inode. Okay, you are doing that indexed allocation in that lab 4, but that is a single-level index. Okay, as you, if you remember, we said typical inodes are multi-level index structures. Okay, so as far as I/O system is concerned, you need to broadly understand how I/O is done within the I/O subsystem. You may have, the simplest case is you do polling and interrupts. Can, once you have an I/O request outstanding, you can keep polling, is it done, or you can wait for an interrupt to come after that. That's the most basic way of doing I/O. Okay? Slightly more sophisticated way is to do what's called direct memory access. Okay? The OS just sends off a command, the CPU sends off a command to the I/O device, and there's something called a DMA controller that takes the data that's coming off that device and directly transfers it to memory without any CPU intervention. Okay? So this reduces the overheads on the CPU of any I/O operation. Okay, anything that has high volume I/O requires direct memory access, or the performance of your system is going to be very bad. Okay, so essentially DMA is like a pseudo CPU that is doing what the CPU would have done. Okay, it's taking data from the I/O device and putting it in memory, just doing the copy back and forth. Okay, so you need to understand what DMA is. Okay, and what DMA-based accesses are, as well as polling and interrupts. And then last thing we looked at there was caching and buffering. We said I/O devices are by definition slow. Okay, so to ensure better performance, typically the OS maintains a cache or a buffer cache for every I/O device. So whenever an I/O request comes in, you first check whether the requested data is in the cache. If so, you just return the result from the cache. If not, you have a cache miss that requires you to actually send the I/O request to the device. Okay? By having large caches, you can reduce the number of requests to the I/O device and improve performance. Okay? So all I/O devices will have a cache. Okay? The most common type of cache is a file system cache. That's storing data from disk in the OS, with the OS buffers. Okay? It is used for improving performance of file I/O. Any questions on that? I/O systems. Okay, so the last component we have been studying over the last 2-3 lectures has been distributed systems. So here you need to understand the definition of a distributed system. Yeah, essentially, it's a collection of processes that run on different CPUs that interact over a network or a communication medium. That's a very basic definition. Okay? Your processes that talk over a network, essentially. Okay, that constitutes a distributed system. You need to understand the different types. Okay, what is a distributed system and how is that different from a parallel system? Okay? The difference lies in the tightness of the coupling. If the processes in the system run on cores within the same machine and the network is your system bus, okay, then you have a parallel system. Okay? If the processes run on CPUs of different machines and the communication medium is an actual network, then you have a distributed system. Okay, so that's the main difference. In one case, the coupling is tight because you're sharing memory, you share the same clock. In another case, the coupling is loose. Okay, so basically you have to communicate over a network, you don't share memory across machines, you have different clocks and whatnot. Okay, so that's the main difference between the two types of systems. Okay, you need to know what are advantages of distributed over centralized system. The fact that you can share resources, the fact that you can scale with the number of machines, the fact that you can tolerate fault, that is failure of any one machine does not have caused the system as a whole to stop. All of those are advantages. Okay? There are disadvantages as well. The complexity of your application goes up. Okay? Programmers have to deal with the networking aspect in their code. So all of those become disadvantages. Okay? So it's not that what advantages, but both advantages and disadvantages. Here's something you need to know. Okay? And we spent a lecture looking at networks, okay, of various kinds. We started with a local area network. Okay, this is a LAN that connects machines within a building or a campus. Okay, then we said there is something that allows networks to span larger distances. Those are called wide area networks or WANs. Okay, the example of a wide area network is the internet. Okay, internet is actually a network of wide area network. Okay, so then we looked at several topologies. Okay, of how do you construct LANs, how do you construct WANs. We started fully connected topology, partially connected, star topology, ring topology. So practically any geometry you can think of, there are topologies of network. Okay, so you need to understand what are the advantages and disadvantages. Okay. Basically, advantages of the more connections you have, fewer hops you have to traverse for messages. Okay. More robust is that network. If some links go down, network can continue to send messages between any two nodes. Okay. The fewer links you have, the more prone you are to network failure. So if there is only one link that connects two groups of machines, if that link goes down, your network gets partitioned. Okay. This is typically what happens when your internet connection in your home goes down. You have one link connecting your home network to the rest of the internet. Your cable modem is down, you have a partitioned network. Or your machines within your home network can talk to one another. Machines outside your home networks can talk to one another. But not, these two groups cannot talk. Okay? So that's an example of what happens when you have fewer connections between nodes. Okay, so you need to know how node failures will affect different topologies and what are the communication costs. Okay, so in a ring topology, for instance, if you have a unidirectional link, the maximum number of hops a message may have to traverse is n-1. Okay, because you may, if you send a message, it might have to go through the whole ring to get to the node you are sending it to. So for any arbitrary topology, you need to know how expensive is it or how cheap is it to send messages. Okay, you need to know what's a packet. Okay, that's a unit of data that you send over a network. Okay, you need to know the concept of this protocol stack. Okay, so this is the layered organization of a network subsystem where each layer in your protocol stack does a certain functionality. We looked at the physical link layer, or rather physical layer, data link layer, network layer, transport layer, application layer. Okay. Example of a protocol stack is TCP/IP. That's the most commonly used protocol stack. So you need to know at least what TCP/IP is. Okay, so in the context of sharing, we looked at data migration, job migration, and computation migration. In one case, the data moves to where the computation is. Right? In another case, the computation moves to where the data is, and job migration both can move. Okay? At least understanding what the concept is and some examples. Okay, we said search query or a database query is an example of computation migration. The query is a piece of code, piece of computation that goes to where the data is, which is a database server or a search engine. Data migration is a different example, where if you download, so we said Google Docs, if you actually download the data to your browser, let's say it's a spreadsheet and you manipulate it, then the data has come to where the program is. That's an example of computation migration. Job migration, we said, are batch simulation systems where you submit a job, it can run, the job and the data move to any machine and they can run there. Okay, so you need to know at least these examples to understand what the differences are. Okay, so remote procedure call, what is a remote procedure call? How does it differ from a normal procedure call? So here you are invoking code on other machines. Okay, so how do you write distributed applications with RPCs? And most importantly, what's the advantage? Okay, why use RPCs? And as I said, what RPC systems do is they hide a lot of the networking details in stub code that's automatically generated. Application programmers can focus on the higher level task of how the application is written, not low level mundane details of how to open a socket and how to communicate with that machine and whatnot. That's dealt for you automatically. Okay. So it raises the level of programming to a much higher level. Okay, than if you did low level networking, or had to write low level networking code. Okay. So, okay, there's a question. Would you ever use RPC to communicate within two processes on the same machine? We didn't actually discuss that, but there's a question. Would you write a RPC system to communicate on the same machine? Yep.
Could you also flexible client server so you can run on one machine at a time?
Yep. If you write your application as a client and server, and the client and server are independent processes, you could use RPCs. There's nothing that prevents RPCs from running. You could of course use other things. You could write your application as a multi-threaded program or a shared memory system. If you are on a single machine, you could also use RPCs. Okay? RPC systems don't distinguish where the client and the server run. They could run on the same machine, they could run elsewhere. The networking code takes care of that for you. Okay? But you can actually have scenarios where RPC systems are actually processes on the same machine. Okay? And then the last part was distributed file system. Okay, so you need to know naming. You need to know what is a distributed file system that has a global namespace. You need to know caching in distributed file systems and advantages of and disadvantages of caching. Okay, performance, consistency, those kinds of things. And then the last thing was today's lecture, which was what is protection. Okay, the important thing to keep in mind is protection is not the same as security. I didn't explicitly mention it. Protection just tells the OS who can access what. Okay. Security is how policies come into play. If you lose policies, you give inadvertent access to someone. It could be a virus, it could be a malicious hacker. Okay, so protection is just a mechanism that implements good security. Okay, so you need to understand the difference between the two. And what is a domain, what are objects, what's an access control matrix, and so on. Okay, so those are things to keep in mind. Last, the same set of things apply. So always, as always, start with lecture slides, look at the lecture notes, then go to the book. Okay, and then you will not get any coding questions. Okay, as has always been the case, you will not be expected to know any details of particular operating systems. We only ask questions about general concepts. Okay. So
there will be programming questions.
Yes, but you don't have to write correct Java code. Pseudo code is good enough, is what that is saying, like we did in synchronization. Okay, so let's end it here. I took an extra 10 minutes, I shouldn't have. But I would like somebody to help with course evaluation. Okay, it needs to go to the main office. Okay, so spend a few minutes. I would appreciate feedback. Okay, I'm going to teach this course again in the fall. So if there's something you hated about the course, I would like to know. Or if you liked something, that's also fine. But feedback would be much appreciated. Okay? So you can want to administer it. Alright. Okay, so I'm going to